You to this 14th session in an ongoing series of webinars on sacred number and geometry. If you'd like to view any of the first 13 sessions, they are available on makara.us. If you have any questions about the GoToMeeting interface, feel free to text BL. In order to save time, we're going to try something a bit different today. Whether or not you have a headset, if you are willing to read one or more of the various quotes that will appear on your screen during this session, and I hope you will be willing to, please raise your hand now. Now, we have about 30 attendees, and we typically have about 40, so there'll be some stragglers who might also wish to read, but if you would be willing to raise your hands now, then BL will call on you. We'll take a tally of who is willing to read, and then call on you when we need a reader. As soon as we get six or so readers, then we'll move on into the webinar. Don't be shy. It's good to hear from as many of you as possible. And by the way, when you read, there's no need to read the book title and author at the end of the quote. So do we have some hands raised there, PL?
We do.
Okay.
I've got five and I need, there we go. Okay. I got six. I actually got seven. So I've
great.
Got six
if,
right now.
Okay, and if you could type this out and post it for the people who are coming in, that would be good. But seven people reading will be just fine. Okay. During our last session, we reviewed DK's teachings on developing the intuition through symbols. We then took a look at the impact that the five-pointed star has made throughout history, and finished with an analysis of the golden spiral. I'd like to start today's session by taking a look at a very particular sequence of numbers. In 1202, Leonardo of Pisa, also known as Fibonacci, wrote a mathematical puzzle. Leonardo of Pisa was among the greatest mathematicians of his time and has been credited with introducing the Arabic number system to Europe. Up till then, people are actually dealing with Roman numerals. So here's the background on his puzzle. Rabbits are able to mate at the age of 1 month, so that at the end of its second month, a female can produce another pair of rabbits. Suppose that the female always produces one new pair, one male and one female, every month from the second month on. The puzzle that Fibonacci posed was, how many pairs of rabbits would there be in 1 year? The answer to this rabbit proliferation puzzle came to be known as the Fibonacci sequence, which are represented by the red numbers on the left, though they continue ad infinitum. Any one of these numbers can be determined simply by adding the two previous numbers together, which is kind of cool, but the special thing about this sequence is that any number in relation to the preceding or following number represents a golden mean ratio of 1 to 1.618, which, as you know by now, is phi. That is to say, if the lower number is multiplied by phi, it will approximate the next number in the series. The higher the number, the closer it gets to the true phi relationship. But even the relationship of 8 to 13 gets us within 1/100th of the true proportion. Now let's take a look at a graphic representation of this sequence. Though this may not seem familiar at first glance, the Fibonacci sequence follows the expanding proportions of the series of pentagram pentagons that we looked at last month. It's kind of astonishing, isn't it, that rabbits in an ideal setting, freed from the vagaries of accidental death. Okay. I have to take a break and close this little window here.
I'm sorry, I took your talking head off.
Yeah, that's just part of the new system software, I guess. Okay, so these rabbits, freed from the vagaries of accidental death, proliferate in accordance with the unfolding proportions of the pentagram pentagon, which is itself the symbol of a great governing potency that demonstrates as phi, a potency that, if you remember from last time, DK tells us is closely related to the fifth initiation. Okay, now let's turn to the plant kingdom, where we have the most precise adherence to the golden mean. In the 16th century, Leonardo da Vinci noted that leaf patterns were often spiral-like. 300 years later, the Bravais brothers made precise measurements and discovered that as the leaves of many plants proliferate, they array themselves at exactly 137.5 degrees, which is 360 degrees divided by phi squared. This has since become known as the golden angle. Leaves of a plant array themselves in this way because only at this exact fraction of a degree do they receive the optimal amount of sunlight. This process is known as phyllotaxis. And if there is a variation of just a tenth of a degree from the golden angle, the even distribution of the leaves is quickly lost. Demonstrations of five and the Fibonacci sequence are found throughout the natural world. Most wildflowers have petals with pentagonal stamens. Edible fruit also has five petaled flowers, a geometry that is also found in the fruit. Cut an apple in half, and you will see the fivefold pattern of its seeds. The disc of seeds in the head of a sunflower grow in two sets of spirals in opposite directions, usually in a ratio of 89 to 55 or 55 to 34, both of which are part of the Fibonacci sequence. The segments of pine cones and artichokes, pineapples, and other plants also follow similar Fibonacci ratios. Many land and sea creatures demonstrate the golden mean in their proportions. The nautilus shell is a kind of poster child for the golden ratio. Even the human figure and face unfold in accordance with the law of phi, which also demonstrates in weather patterns and even in the planets. Here is a phi demonstrating in the proportions of the rings of Saturn, and then the relation of the center point of the Earth to the Moon. Take a good look at this triangle. We'll see it again when we consider the Great Pyramid. It's easy to find examples of the dynamic phi ratio. They're everywhere. What's more difficult is to find info on the causal law itself. There's an interesting scientific theory described on cosmometry.net. The anonymous author states, well, let's get a reader for this. Try out our new system.
Okay, Tanya, please go ahead. Ooh, we have some really bad noise there.
Let's just go to the next reader then.
Okay. Arrest, let me unmute you. There you go, Arrest.
Is the angular movement that results from the balanced shearing of the two primary expressions of all energy in the cosmos, radiation and gravitation, expansion and contraction. It is also the zero point of the active movement of energy as it flows both in towards and out from a common center point, whether an atomic nucleus, a flower head, a hurricane, a star, a galaxy, etc.
Thank you, Orest. I like the idea of the balance sharing of two primary expressions as it flows both in towards and out from a common center point. It seems to describe the grip and loosening of the grip of matter, and also suggests involution and evolution. On the involutionary path, a unit of consciousness comes under more and more under the sway of gravity. Evolutionally, we become radiatory and even radioactive. The eminent esotericist and Egyptologist R. A. Schwaller de Lubitsch considered Phi to be the creative function, the fire of life itself. He states in his magnum opus, The Temple of Man. Well, let's get another reader here.
Okay, part. Next up is Scott, please.
Since every generation involves a growth in volume, since all growth can only take place in a harmonious rhythm, that is to say, proportional to a particular coefficient, and since this rhythm is indisputably ordained by Phi, it is sufficient to know the module coefficient particular to the species, or to the individual member of the species, or of the netter principle to make a living, harmoniously, magically, correct form, developing an architecture or image from this module with Phi.
Thank you. Okay, later in this same work, Schwaller de Lubitsch makes another statement. How about another reader for this statement?
Okay, Michael, you are up, please. Thank you.
The golden number does not act solely as a function of an ideal proportion, but serves as the basis for a philosophy that makes the connection between the metaphysical state and the physical state. It is in this connection that the golden number's sacred character consists.
Thanks, Michael. DK corroborates this concept. He tells us the fivefold shape of physical man is the result of the fivefold direction of force currents from five centers. The force emanating from these five, therefore, sweeps the dense substance into a close aggregation. Sounds suspiciously Phi-like, doesn't it? Remember, Phi is expressed wherever there is five points arrayed geometrically. So if we bring the teachings of DK and Schwaller de Lubitsch together, we could say Phi is a law that bridges the metaphysical and physical, thereby sweeping substance into a close aggregation. Okay. There are two three-dimensional figures that are especially associated with the number 5, and thus with Phi. The dodecahedron, which has 12 pentagonal faces, and the pyramid. Today, we'll be taking a look at the pyramid. Peter Tompkins, author of The Secret of the Pyramid, says, "The pyramid's shape precisely incorporates the fundamental proportions of the golden section." Of course, a pyramid is any figure with four triangular faces and a square base. But there are three types of pyramids that reflect the proportions of the golden ratio. In the first of these, the sharp pyramid, also called the Russian pyramid, the length of a side divided by phi determines the width of the base. This renders a 72-degree angle from the horizontal. 72 degrees, you may remember, is one-fifth of the circumference of a circle and is thus inherently expressive of the phi ratio. Over 20 of these pyramids have been constructed throughout Russia, some as tall as 144 feet. Russian scientists have been researching the effects of these pyramids for years. Here's a sampling of their result. And if we could, let's get a reader for this list. It's a fascinating list of results.
Okay, they're listed as Martha and Gabrielle. Please,
great.
One of you go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. The immune systems of organisms is improved. Specifically, blood leukocyte composition is increased. Standard tissue culture tests show an increase in survival of cellular tissue after infection by viruses and bacteria. There is an improved regeneration of tissue. Seeds stored in these pyramids for 1 to 5 days show a 30 to 100% increase in yield. A study was done on 5,000 prisoners who ingested salt and pepper that had been exposed to the pyramid's energy field. The test subjects exhibited a greatly reduced violence rate, and their overall behavior was much improved. Physicists observed significant changes in superconductivity temperature thresholds and in the properties of semiconducting and carbon nanomaterials. And lastly, water placed inside the pyramids remains liquid to minus 40 degrees Celsius, but freezes instantly if jostled or bumped in any way.
Huh. Thank you. And of course, your razor blades will stay sharp if you keep them in the family pyramid. Pyramid power is nothing new, but the usual model for pyramid construction is based on the Great Pyramid of Giza, which we'll be looking at today. But before we move into an analysis of this figure, I'd like to introduce DK's expanded version of the three-part analysis we've been using for the last many sessions. Here are the five stages. Can we get a reader for this?
Okay, Leah, let me unmute you. There you go, Leah.
Thank you. It's exoteric consideration, line, form, and color. A comprehension in the astral or emotional body of its quality, the reaction of a sensitive response to the impact of its qualitative nature. A conceptual consideration of its underlying idea, of what it is intended to teach, of the intellectual meaning it is intended to convey. The stage of the synthetic grasp of the purpose of a symbol of its place in an ordered manifesting plan, of its true unified intent. Identification with the quality and purpose of the symbol as it is illuminated by the mind held steady in the light. This final stage brings into activity the brain as well as the mind.
Thank you. So you can see we're looking at an expanded version of the three points or stages that we've traditionally dealt with, and especially numbers 4 and 5 take it a step further. And so it should be interesting to go through these stages with you. So let's start with the first of these five stages, which is the same as our previous first stage, though stated more simply. Simply says it's exoteric consideration, line, form, and color. So, what can we say about the line, form, and color of a pyramid modeled after the dimensions of the Great Pyramid of Giza, as pictured here? At this point, we're not looking for meaning or significance, but rather for a tabulation of this figure's physical attributes. Let's start by focusing on the outer shape of the pyramid modeled after the dimensions of the Greater Pyramid of Giza, not on the Great Pyramid itself or in its many fascinating interior parts. As we make our mental list, we invite you to participate when called on. Please briefly describe a single physical attribute of this figure. Your observation may seem obvious, like the ones listed here. That's fine. any ideas that help us to physically define this figure are useful. Okay, I'll start. A pyramid has 5 vertices, 5 faces, and 8 edges. 4 of the faces are triangular, 1 is square. So, any further observations? What other physical attributes do you see? Tobiel, do we have any takers on?
I don't see any hands or any comments yet.
Let's give it.
Here we go. Here we go.
Okay.
Please go ahead, Scott.
4 isosceles triangles.
Close to. It's actually not quite 60 degrees, but yes, isosceles triangles. I was hearing equilateral. You're absolutely correct. 4 isosceles triangles. Correct. Thank you. Anyone else? Other
Martha, the center point at the top lies directly over the center of the square.
Very good. Yes, indeed. Thank you, Martha. Other
yes,
observations?
Hold on. Go ahead, please, Terry.
There are 5 points.
Yes, indeed.
Top. 4. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Thanks, Terry. Good. Any other observations? Physical attributes.
I don't see any more. Here we go. Go ahead again, please, Scott.
Are we talking about the degrees and the angles of these?
If you'd like, you're welcome to.
51 degrees, 51 minutes.
Yeah, that's correct. The upward angle of the sides is 51 degrees and 51 minutes. So this clearly comes from some pre-knowledge on Scott's part. You wouldn't be able to tell this just by looking at it. But we're happy to, if you do happen to know, aspects of this pyramid, then please feel free to share physical aspects.
How about 751 feet, more or less, to a side, 400.
Oh, wait a minute. No, this is, the angle is relevant even to a pyramid based on the shape of the Great Pyramid, but when you go there, then you're going to the Great Pyramid itself. So we're going to hold off on that. We'll be getting there shortly, but thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, at this point, we're just keeping it generic because I want to focus on the inherent power of the shape, whether it happens to be the Great Pyramid or not.
Go ahead, please, Arrest.
It's either solid or it encloses a space.
Say that again, Arrest.
It is either a geometric solid.
Oh, uh-huh.
Or it may be a surface enclosing space.
Yes, indeed. Right. That's a good point. That observation we've actually never made before with any three-dimensional object, and that is always true, isn't it? So, yes, indeed.
You asked for basics.
That's fine. That's what we want. Mostly, the physical attributes are basic in their quality. So, anyone else have an observation?
Yes, we have a comment again from Martha. It's an incredibly stable figure resting on the square.
Yes, it's, in fact, I don't know this for a fact, but I believe that the only more stable figure is the tetrahedron, which has 3 triangular sides on top and 1 triangular base. And I believe that's the only, because that's considered the single most stable figure. Though, frankly, for whatever reason, it seems like this would be even more stable with a square bottom, but it certainly is. If you were to press on the top of this figure, it would resist pressure very well. Other thoughts? Other ideas?
Scott, please go ahead.
It's half an octahedron.
It is indeed, except for that an octahedron would be made of equilateral triangles, but it certainly approaches that shape.
Okay.
Yes. Anyone else?
Arrest?
From a sculptural point of view, it has the physical characteristic of visual white.
A visual white? Is that what you said?
White, like heaviness.
Oh, wait. A white, of course. Yes. Yes, it does. That's true. It has a sense of intense compactness and of weight. In fact, I can visualize, you know, iron weights made in this shape.
Which relates to gravity.
Yes. Yeah. I thought you were getting very abstract on us there, Orest, with the visual white, you know.
Not yet.
I was racing after you to find, you know, just what you meant. But, yeah. Other thoughts? Any other physical? We're getting a good list going here. Any other thoughts?
I don't see any hands or any further comments.
Okay, well, if something occurs to you, feel free to break in.
Here we go, Arrest.
Here's some addition. Yeah, go
ahead.
The
only other thing that I can think of is direction. So the points lead to or indicate directions like north, east, south, west, up, down sort of thing.
Mm.
That would be a physical characteristic, I assume.
Yeah, it certainly would be. Yeah, yeah. Right. In fact, from the square, which indicates the two-dimensional directions of, you know, cardinal directions, that you can also add the up direction to this. And in that way, you can see that it has a similar quality to the five-pointed star, which, if you remember, in ancient times, this was in the last webinar, that was considered to be a representation of the four cardinal directions and up. So, and I think in many ways this is a more effective symbol of that. Okay, anyone else?
Yes, Helena says on the ascent to the tip, the area in question decreases.
Yes, indeed. That's a very important point. That, in fact, I didn't include it, but there is a graph that shows the percentage of the pyramid in terms of the weight or the building materials as you go up, and it's amazing how quickly it moves towards an area of a great deal less volume, right? It's, if I remember right, about half the material is in the first quarter of the pyramid. So yes, Helena, it's a very good point. Any other thoughts? Okay. Like I say, if you get a flash, just feel free to actually hold until I finish listing my views, and then if I haven't listed it, then please come forward and add your physical attribute. Okay. A lot of the attributes that are particular to the shape, you couldn't know by simply looking at the shape. For instance, the one that Scott pointed out, that it's at an angle of 51 degrees and 51 minutes. The orthogonal top view of a pyramid is an equal arm cross, or X, bound by a square. The apex of the pyramid, oh, but this is one Martha brought up. Wait a minute, it's jumping around on me here. Okay. The apex of the pyramid, which is the fifth vertice, and the center point of the cross, stands directly above the center point of the square base. I repeat myself so that you can see the illustration here. The orthogonal view, side view of the pyramid, is a flattened equilateral triangle. which can be generated using a vesicapesis. When the slope of a pyramid is precisely 51 degrees and 51 minutes, a number of mathematical phenomena occurs. For instance, at this angle, and only at this angle, the height of the pyramid, and that's the dotted line that comes up through the orange triangle, right? The height of the pyramid is in ratio to the perimeter of its base. That's the addition of the four sides of a yellow square there. It's in relation, in ratio to the perimeter of the base as the radius of a circle based on that height is to its circumference. Okay, if you just went brain dead on me, let's take this step by step. So in other words, when using the height of the pyramid as the radius, that's the height of the orange triangle, this circumference and this circumference are the same, okay? When this square and circle are superimposed, we have a phenomena called squaring the circle. Okay, another result of the 51 degree, 51 minute angle is that each face of the pyramid is uniquely able to represent one curved quarter of half a sphere. This is a function of phi that allows this to occur. In order for this to work, the curved base of the quadrant must be the same length as the straight edge of the base of the pyramid. Okay, yet another result of the 51 degrees, 51 minute slope is that the area of each of the triangular faces is equal to the square of the pyramid's height. This relationship brings the golden ratio into play, and that's all you really need to know. For when the height of the pyramid's apothem, and apothem is the height of a side, when that apothem is divided by half the base length, the result is a ratio of 89 to 55, which is about 1/1000th of 1% from phi. This suggests that the Egyptians were aware of the numerical sequence that thousands of years later would be attributed to Fibonacci. So, as shown here, if half the base length is 1, the apothem is phi, and the height is the square root of phi. Now, does this seem familiar? It's the same triangle that we looked at in this illustration, meaning that yet another attribute of the pyramid, patterned after the Great Pyramid, is that it describes the size and angular relationship between the Earth's equator and the center of the moon. Through Herodotus, we know that the ancient Greeks knew that the Great Pyramid was built to these proportions. In fact, the pyramid's proportions are a prime example of the fact that many of the mathematical discoveries attributed to ancient Greece actually originated in Egypt, such as the Pythagorean triangle, which is demonstrated in the dimensions of the King's Chamber. Okay, except for the King's Chamber example, all the above physical attributes apply to any pyramid whose shape is patterned after the Great Pyramid. But there are some attributes that apply only to the Great Pyramid itself. Chief among these is the fact that the Great Pyramid was constructed to be a precise mathematical model of the northern hemisphere of the Earth. As you know, the map of the Earth is divided into 360 degrees of longitude and latitude, with each degree further divided into 60 minutes. Agatharchides of Cnidus, whose title was guardian of the Egyptian pharaoh, noted that the length of the base of one side of the pyramid corresponds to 1/8 a minute of a degree of the Earth's latitude, and the apothem to 1/10 of a minute of a degree. Now remember, Europeans thought the Earth was flat thousands of years after this precisely accurate model of the Northern Hemisphere was built. And, you know, 12 to 1300 years after Agatharchides wrote his observations, it's really a rather remarkable aspect of the pyramids. 17 centuries after Agatharchides, the French archaeologist Edme Francois Jomard measured the apothem of the pyramid and was astonished to find that at 184.722 meters, it was precisely 1/10 of the 1847.22 meters, which is the length of a minute of latitude at the 29th parallel where the pyramid was constructed. Since Jomard's time, it's been discovered that twice the length of the base of the pyramid, okay, twice around the base of the pyramid equals exactly 1 minute of latitude at the equator, thus strengthening the theory that the Egyptians built the Great Pyramid at Giza to be a mathematical representation of the Northern Hemisphere. Now, how the ancients could have known the length of a minute of latitude at the equator when the rest of the world was still trying to figure out what the shape of the world was, this is just part of the great mystery that's come down to us from these masters of architecture and mathematics who constructed this, who constructed the pyramid. Okay, the pyramid was also precisely aligned to the cardinal directions, thus allowing the ancient Egyptians to determine the solstices and the equinoxes, as is illustrated in this chart from The Secrets of the Great Pyramid by Peter Tompkins. As you can see, there is a precise alignment along the pyramid's diagonal lines for sighting sunrise and sunset on the shortest and longest days of the year, whereas sightings of sunrise and sunset of the two equinoxes were made from the center of the east and west sides. These sightings were aided by the shadows cast by the pyramid. There was flat paving stones extended in all directions from the pyramid so that the shadows were part of the observations made. The accuracy of the cardinal placement of the pyramid led William Petrie, who was one of the earliest scientific archaeologists, to state, "The pyramid's error, both in length and in angles, could be covered by placing one's thumb on them," suggesting that if you put your thumb on the pyramid, that that would cover any error that might exist. The Great Pyramid was also used as an observatory, but probably not in its finished state. Built at an angle of 26 degrees and 17 minutes, a descending passage that culminates in what is called the pit, deep beneath the pyramid, is precisely aligned to what would have been the North Star when the pyramid was under construction. After millennia, this 350-foot-long passage is still true to within a quarter inch side to side and a tenth of an inch top to bottom. Just an astonishing feat. That's after untold millennia of, quote, settling, unquote. And it's been hypothesized that the peculiar shape of the Grand Gallery's roofline aided the ancient astronomers in viewing the heavens. Of course, this would have had to happen, as is shown in this previous slide there to the left. This would have all happened before the pyramid was actually finished, because all these passages were eventually blocked. Okay, this map shows the pyramid's location in relationship to the delta of the Nile. Note how the diagonal lines emanating from the much enlarged pyramid at the bottom of this map embrace the delta area. Okay, though some of the attributes I've mentioned may seem somewhat technical, we've barely scratched the mathematical surface, as you can see from these calculations from Samuel Laboy, who has gone into great depth concerning the mathematical aspects of the Great Pyramid. But we can understand this much. The Great Pyramid gives us a precisely aligned, large-scale demonstration of pi, phi, and the squaring of the circle in a structure that accurately represents the northern hemisphere of the Earth. In fact, it's the largest and most precisely oriented, purely geometric 3D structure ever constructed, by far. But why was it built? With this question, let's move into the second part of our analysis. DK separates the next stage into two parts as follows. Can we get a reader for these two?
Okay, Clesia, you're up, but you're on self-mute. There you go. Thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
The comprehension in the astral or emotional body of its quality, the reaction of a sensitive response to the impact of its qualitative nature, a conceptual consideration of its underlying idea of what it is intended to teach, of intellectual meaning it is intended to convey.
Thank you, Glacia. Okay, if you remember last time when we were reviewing some of the teachings on the intuition and symbology, if you remember, DK emphasized the importance of having an emotional response because it reflects the Buddhic. And so hence he has divided this part, which we normally think of as the as more of in terms of meaning, he's divided this into both the feeling quality and the conceptual considerations. So in the interest of time, we're still going to consider these two steps at the same time as we have in past sessions. But when you're sharing, you're welcome to speak to either of these two stages. So, considering our list of physical attributes, and a few additional ones were made by you, what quality, significance, and or meaning can we ascribe to a pyramid patterned after the Great Pyramid of Giza? Here's one example, each based on quality or significance and meaning. Just to get you thinking in this direction, the pyramid feels to me like a bridge between two worlds. The square base and four triangular ascending sides suggest the grounding of spirit in the world of form. And then secondly, the pyramid was not built to be a granary, as was thought up until a couple of centuries ago, nor was it a burial site, as is still believed to this day by many traditional Egyptologists. That's the party line. The esoteric tradition states that it was built to facilitate initiation and is far older than it is believed to be. So, any further ideas about the quality, significance, and or meaning of the pyramid? Either a pyramid based on the pyramid of the Great Giza or the pyramid the Great Pyramid, or the Great Pyramid itself. As you're thinking about these two points, you may wish to consider our list of physical attributes. And take a minute to review these and see if, as you're perusing this list or recalling those other physical attributes that were brought up, if something occurs to you as to the quality, significance, and meaning of the pyramid. Let me know, BL, when we have
the tape. Yeah, here we go.
Okay.
Please go ahead, Arrest.
The law of correspondence comes to mind.
Hmm. Can you say a little more about that?
As above, so below. There's something that's relating that mathematically, but it's just a feeling that this is a symbol of linkage. I use the word aspiration, so it's like a symbol of a feeling of aspiration, linking the higher and the lower, and somehow, you know, that's what came to me.
I appreciate that, Orest, and I'm very glad that you addressed yourself to the quality significance side of this. You know, having such powerful mental equipment, that's very interesting. You know, and I share your experience of this shape, which is that it's inherently uplifting. It's aspirational, and it's just something about it. And the idea of it being a linking form that links, possibly because it diminishes and then disappears, so to speak, at the top point of the pyramidion. Okay, other ideas?
Yes, we have a couple of hands, but first I'd like to read what Martha says, and this follows very closely with what you just said. It's sort of the inverse of Francis's words, those were your previous ones. Also seems to me like an embodiment of aspiration, a lifting of the spirit from form, ascending.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. Well, yeah, this is along the same lines. Thank you. Okay.
Scott, please go ahead.
Hello?
Yes.
Ah, okay. Thinking of the shape is certainly a mountain. It's that aspiration of lifting up out of earth of the fourness into three. The fact that it's a symbol and has a feeling of fire. And pyramid itself, of course, means fire in the middle.
Hmm. Yes.
That's what's going on in this temple.
I'm sorry, say that last sentence again.
That's what's going on and what's going on in this temple. It's fire in the middle.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the fact that it is like a man-made mountain. It's almost, in a sense, like a perfected mountain in terms of its idealized qualities. And this brings in, you know, one of those 12 astrological signs. Well, what was that again? come on, Capricorn, speak up. Yes, this would be the mountaintop of initiation. So what could be more apropos? Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
In fact, also, that this is, going back to the octahedron, that this is not made as an octahedron, as you pointed out, and it's only approximates, that would be the natural form, perhaps. But this one is very special, and not using 60-degree angles, but 51-51.
Right.
Coming from another level of awareness and application.
Yes, indeed. It has a natural basis, as we can see, you know, by the fact that it can be derived from the Vesica Pisces, the baseline of the Vesica Pisces, and also because all these transrational functions, just at that minute of a degree, spring into action. So I agree with you that it is a it's as though it's a inherently monastic in its function, as opposed to pure equilateral triangles, which would give us the natural form. It's a good point. Okay, folks, other ideas?
Yes, please go ahead, Martin.
Hi. Just one word comes to mind, and that is quintessence, and there's a lot to be said about that. I think of the Ajna Center, which is ruled by the Ray 5, and then the Transfiguration, which is the fifth ray, and I think of the fifth element, which is etheric, and I think of what you pointed out earlier from cosmometry about both the gravitational force inward, which is the weightiness, which was referred to, and then what you referred to as this aspiration upward to an ascending point of a point of ascension. So it's all implied in quintessence in my mind, and there's a lot more to be said, but quintessential energy and mastery and identification with the five-pointed star are all implied in the word quintessence.
Yes, they are. And, you know, if you use the other side of the gravitational dichotomy, you have that radiation, which, you know, you could almost say that radiation partakes of quintessence by breaking free of the laws of gravity, which, and what are the laws of gravity? The law of form, right? If you partake of physical form, you partake of the law of gravity. And as you move into a radiatory field, you actually escape that law. That's actually what radioactivity is, escaping the ring, your own ring pass not. And I like that idea of the quintessence. And the apex being the fifth point, the fifth vertice, seems to speak very particularly of this quintessence. And we'll see some illustrations that show that later. Thank you very much, Martin.
That's okay.
Good thought. Anyone else?
Orest, please go ahead. Orest?
The etheric grid is suggested that it's a cube, and this is indicated by the base, and there's a transition of the etheric cube towards the sphere, and the first part of this would be moving from the cube or the square to a triangular or a pyramid formation. So that there's a sense of the transition from the grid system, which is utilizing the cube, to utilizing the pyramid or the square, other triangle.
Yes, that actually, that's brilliant. You remember a few webinars back, we read a DK quote that describes how at this time the etheric is made up of a series of squares, but as we move into awareness of the true self, that these will be transformed into a triangular shaped etheric web. And I absolutely agree with you that this suggests that transition. And not just suggests it, but enables it, because this isn't a static symbol by any means. Thanks, Orest. Other thoughts?
Yes, we've got a couple of comments. Suzanne says the quintile in astrology also comes to mind. And Martha says moving upward, the sense of leaving the form.
Yes.
And then
moving out of the form world, yes.
Right. And then Terry, please go ahead. Terry?
I think the point to a particular star or stars. I don't know what it is, I'm afraid, but I think there's been a discussion over this.
Yeah, there has.
Positive point too.
Yeah, and also that's changed because of the precession of the equinox. So it has shifted. I believe at one point it was Draconis, star in Draconis. Alpha Centauri comes to mind. Scott, do you happen to remember which star that was the North Star at the time of the building of the pyramid? Or speculation? Any speculation on that? Or does anyone?
I don't. More speculation on how old the pyramid is, and then go from there. There's a set number of stars up there. The apparently, that we
That's right.
rotate around to. But I don't know where it was when it was built.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because indeed, then we would have to know when it was built to know which star, and we don't. So it could have been one of any one of those few stars that come into the exact north point during the precession of the equinoxes. But thank you, Jerry, for that. Other ideas?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I thought the formation of the belt of Orion has to do with the pyramids.
Uh-huh.
It's aligned to the pyramids.
That's it. I'm not aware of this. It very well may, or it possibly it did at one time. Yeah. Because another thing is, you know, the if you remember the illustration of the Grand Gallery, which has that kind of reversed corbel roof line, there's speculation that those corbels were actually built in such a way that they could determine the angles between stars, and that it allowed them to see, as the seasons passed, something like 80% of the south, the southern sky, because it was oriented towards the south. So, you know, very possibly the, you know, some of these constellations were viewed and were quite important at that time. Thank you. Other thoughts, folks?
I don't see any other hands or comments at this time.
Okay. Here's some additional ideas. The five-faced pyramid seems to be a particularly relevant geometry for humankind, with its square base representing the physical form and the ascending triangular faces, humankind's higher principles. In fact, as the pyramid rises, this point was made, Helena made this point, as the pyramid rises, its bulk diminishes, culminating at a single point with no bulk at all, suggesting the progressive stages into formlessness. I find it provocative that the apex of the pyramid is also the center of the cross when viewed from the top, suggesting the resurrection and ascension of the fourth initiation. And if you, you know, consider that if the pyramid represents humanity or a single initiate or the path of an initiate, that you, in a sense, escape the fourness of the pyramid at the time of the fourth and subsequent fifth initiation. So there's some basis there. The philosophical implications of squaring the circle have been with us since ancient times. Usual interpretation is that is a reconciliation of spirit and matter, or the balance of the two, which is a stage reached in initiation. Through its geometry, the pyramid is expressive of many transrational functions. These functions are great potencies, transformative potencies. The pyramid is expressive of pi, the square root of 2, the square root of 3 through the Vesica Pisces formation, the square root of 5 if you take a diagonal through the King's to the Cube of the King's Chamber, as well as the golden ratio, phi. Pi, expressed through the pyramid's vertical height in relation to a circle that is the same circumference as its base, is the numeral expression of duality. This duality is embedded in its numerical code 31415, the ones here representing unity, and the 3, 4, and 5 defining the nature of duality. 3 plus 4 plus 5 equals 12, the cosmic sum total of manifestation in its potential state. You may remember from a webinar last year wherein we hypothesized that 3, 4, and 5 represented the elements, the builders, and the numbers, and that the two ones represented the essences and the flames. This all from stanza 4, verse 3 of the Secret Doctrine. It could be argued that in the elements of builders and the numbers, we have one, the materials necessary for manifestation, two, those who wield those materials, right? The elements are the materials necessary for the manifestation, and then, of course, those who wield those materials are the builders, and then the numbers providing the blueprint by which an intelligent application of those materials can be wrought, all interpenetrated by the essences and energized by the fires. We also looked at that peculiar numerical relationship between pi and phi, a relationship encoded in the Great Pyramid. Now, in phi, which is also defined by the height of the pyramid, but in relationship to the square base rather than the circle, we move from the potential manifestation of pi to an actual, to use DK's words, sweeping into the world of form. By means of their common radius, pi and phi, the circle representing the noumenal ideation of form manifests through phi as the square, form in the three worlds, or, in biblical terms, the word made flesh. We could hypothesize that pi and phi, working in conjunction, provide an environment that facilitates the initiatory process by making accessible to the acolyte the bridging energy of these two transrational functions. I show this illustration because it's it was the astrological interpretation of Leo, but in fact it's a kind of a Leo Virgo cusp, because that's part of the great mystery of the Sphinx. Okay, Manly Hall gave this colorful description of initiation in the pyramid. Can we get a reader for this? Whoever reads, you can start at the second paragraph that begins the candidate.
Okay, Martin, can you please?
Oh, you want me to read?
Yes, please.
You have the wrong Martin, but I'll read anyway. The candidate, says Hall, was laid in the great stone coffin, and for 3 days his spirit, freed from its mortal coil, wandered at the gateways of eternity. His ka, as a bird, flew through the spiritual spheres of space. He discovered that all the universe was life, all the universe was progress, all the universe was eternal growth. Realizing that his body was a house which he could slip out of and return to without death, he achieved actual immortality. At the end of 3 days, he returned to himself again, and having thus personally and actually experienced the great mystery, he was indeed an initiate, one who beheld, and one to whom religion had fulfilled her duty, bringing him to the light of God.
Thank you, Martin. That was very nicely read. Okay, to take a closer look at how the transrational energies might have facilitated initiation, let's consider the interior of the Great Pyramid. You may remember this chart from our last webinar showing the division of phi occurring at the third subplane of the mental plane, the plane of the soul. Above that, as you can see on this chart, is numbered 1, which here stands for unity, and then 1 over phi, suggesting the state called, that we call the personality. Okay, now, when we overlay this map on DK's chart illustrating the cosmic physical plane, thus dividing the pyramid into 49 levels, we find that the King's Chamber exactly embraces the 7 subplanes of the mental plane, with its peaked roof piercing into the lowest subplane of the Buddhic plane, and that each of the spaces above the king's chamber embrace one of the five higher subplanes of the mental plane. Now here's a close-up view of the king's chamber so you can see what it actually looks like. And then to the left, you see this is a big blow-up of this chart that you were just looking at, showing the mental plane. And as I transferred this as precisely as I could, and you can see how it's quite a close fit. You know, each of these areas above the king's chamber seems to represent one subplane of the higher mental plane. It's curious that it also includes the fifth subplane. Okay, note too that the queen's chamber embraces the lower three subplanes of the astral plane. That's the little peaked roof there in the middle, there on the astral plane. And that the grand gallery, which is that thick ascending area that moves between the queen's chamber and the king's chamber, the grand gallery, which ascends to the king's chamber, passes up through all seven subplanes of the astral plane. When we superimpose a golden spiral on our map, we find that the vertical level of the eye of the spiral embraces the red granite sarcophagus. Perhaps this was why the king's chamber was offset from the central axis. Now, I claim no accuracy as to the left to right positioning, the horizontal positioning of the spiral, though it seemed to work out very nicely. However, its vertical positioning is decreed by the spiral itself. That eye of the spiral does land at the vertical level of the sarcophagus, you can see there, right at the subfloor of the king's chamber. It's just fascinating. I was, this superimposition was quite an eye-opener. There's a number of other aspects to this chart, but time is precious, so we'll need to move on. As mentioned earlier, the eminent esoteric Egyptologist Ari Schwaller de Lubitsch considered Phi to be the creative function, which he called the fire of life itself. This is interesting when we consider the fact, and Scott mentioned this, that the word pyramid means fire in the center. Pyramid, right? Fire in the center. So could the pyramid's energetic center be the eye of the golden spiral designed to embrace the sarcophagus in the king's chamber? Manly Hall's eloquence notwithstanding, there are, of course, no ancient accounts of an acolyte's experience in the initiatory sarcophagus. But in modern times, many have had the opportunity to spend the night in the king's chamber. John Anthony West tells us in his Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt. And could we get a reader for this?
Okay, but hold on just one second. You got a comment here from Mar. Much more can be learned from a book called The Giza Power Plant, Technologies of Ancient Egypt by Christopher Dunn. Now let's ask Mar to read, okay?
That's what you get, Mar, when you speak up like that.
Okay, you can hear me, right?
Yes.
Okay. Since Napoleon's time, any number of visitors have managed to spend a night alone in the pyramid, and many of these have reported going through strange and unique experiences. Napoleon himself spent a night in the king's chamber and emerged white and shaken.
Thank you, Mar. I have myself spent a night in the king's chamber, and in addition to a strongly heightened vibration, I discovered that when I sounded a certain tone from within the red granite sarcophagus, it produced a deep note in response, loud enough to overshadow my own voice. Okay, the next stage in DK's analysis.
You have a question from Launa.
Hi, Launa.
Hello. I wanted to say when I didn't spend the night, but my sister and I were allowed to go up there alone, and I couldn't resist lying down in the sarcophagus just like you. I began to use the Om, and it never ended. It just continued, and it was like another voice. It overcame mine.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you, Launa. Okay, so the next stage of DK's analysis is threefold and takes us a step beyond what we have considered in previous sessions. He tells us the stage of the synthetic grasp of the purpose of a symbol, of its place in an ordered manifesting plan, of its true unified intent. This stage is not about attributes, rather it has to do with synthesis and unity, synthetic purpose, and unified intent. Just as the first stage has to do with the physical plane, the second with the astral, and the third with the mental plane, this plane suggests we apply our intuition and thus achieve a Buddhic plane awareness of our subject. Notice, too, that this stage is threefold. The stage of the synthetic grasp of the purpose of a symbol, of its place in an ordered manifesting plan, of its true unified intent. So, what is the synthetic purpose or unified intent of the Great Pyramid, and what may have been its place in an ordered manifesting plan? This may be one of the very biggest questions that's asked during this series of webinars. What is the synthetic purpose or unified intent of the Great Pyramid, and what may have been its place in an ordered manifesting plan? Just as our list of physical attributes helps to extrapolate significance and meaning, perhaps our list of significance and meaning will help point us towards a synthetic understanding of the purpose and place of the Great Pyramid. We might ask, what single purpose embraces all the attributes listed here? Any ideas? Take a moment to consider. This is nobody can answer this off the top of their head. And BL, let me know when you get a response. But feel free to take your time. We have a minute to spare on this very, very large question.
You have a couple of takers. Martin, please go ahead.
Yes, what comes to mind is planetary man and individual man, and that basically, as was shown, the five, the quintessential point of fire in the middle, applies both to the Earth, the planetary man, and clearly to the individual. And this is somehow represented in 51 degrees, 51 minutes. And in other words, I think that it implies that both we as conscious mediators in the schema and the planetary logos as a conscious mediator on the cosmic level have something in common, and that commonality is expressed in the Great Pyramid.
That's beautifully said, and very possibly the microcosmic individual can access his greater counterpart by partaking of the mysteries in the Great Pyramid. That's very nicely stated, Martin. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Anyone else? So be a question.
Arrest, please go ahead.
The one word, anti-Karana.
Mm-hmm. I agree wholeheartedly. Yes, indeed. In fact, the chart that I described, which shows the King's Chamber embracing the seven planes of the seven subplanes of the mental plane, also embraces specifically that region where the Antikorana must be built. So I agree with you, absolutely. Anyone else?
Walter, please go ahead.
Hey, Walter.
Yes. There we go. So for me, a big purpose and significance to the Great Pyramid, I would sum up with the word evolution, where the pyramid is kind of like a, the Great Pyramid is like a marker of where the involutionary process ends and the evolutionary process begins. In other words, it's really a marker of evolution where it's dense and you know, dense in material but reaching up. And so it really has, when you're really thinking of the purpose of the physical world as a realm of experience for the soul, the having it so spiritual but yet so earthy and material really emphasizes almost like the purpose of physical existence and the planet. So you really get that strong impression looking at the Great Pyramid and feeling it, is that you're fully material but beginning and really reaching up. And also it really brings to mind fire in the center, the thinking of the three aspects of Fohat, Prana, and then that third aspect, Kundalini, that Kundalini fire, which stimulates the evolutionary process, where really the Great Pyramid can indicate that initiatory change from just simple materialism to like materialism infused with spirit.
Yes. Yeah, this is why, you know, they didn't build a tetrahedron, right? It needs the square base in order to ground it, in order to connect it with the earth. And yet, from that base level, it's purely aspirational, or as you said, evolutional. Thank you, Walter. You know, I still remember that when we were reviewing the tetrahedron or going through the physical attributes that you said, it points up. It's the only of the Platonic solids that points up. And here you are again with an up-pointing form. So thank you, Walter. Anyone else want to tread this where angels fear to go?
So okay.
Big question.
We have a couple of comments, one by Mar. It's a power plant designed by Toth, a.k.a., and I'm going to butcher all these names, Ningashida or something like that. Anyway, we'll come to him in a minute because he's got his hand up too. And then Suzanne says, I wonder about the possibility of a connection with Venus, whose essence is the dance of the five-pointed star and many things five, in reference again to the 51 angle and the fire in the center.
Absolutely. Yes, you know, with Venus, our planetary twin, and the two evolutionary plans of these two heavenly men deeply interconnected, one can't imagine that the pyramid would not be strongly influenced by Venus and its fiveness. Yes. Okay. Anyone else?
Yes, we've got a couple more, but let's go to Mar. He's got his hand up, and Mar, you may want to restate that and say the names properly.
I require that you restate it.
hey guys. So can you hear me, right? Hear me, right? Okay. So I just became fascinated with Sumerian archaeology and history. I just read all of Sitchin's, 13.9 or 13 books and other books. I just finished a book called The Giza Power Plant, which I highly recommend everyone go to Kindle and get this now since we started this conversation. It turns out that what Launa just said, Launa said she was in the sarcophagus and she started to ohm and the whole chamber started to vibrate, overshadowing what she started with the simple little ohm coming from little Launa. That is because the Giza pyramid is a power plant. It says so in all of the ancient tablets that are coming out of the ground in the Middle East. It's stated in various channeled works, and this gentleman, Christopher Dunn, who wrote this book, The Giza Power Plant, kind of does all the math and figures out that as the same way that Harold Moses always tells us about harmonics and overtones, they were able to take the heartbeat of the earth and amplify it through this chambering system and project it out, because the Anunnaki used this as a landing beacon and like a tractor beam that helped them catapult gold out of orbit, which was their whole purpose. And the reason why we're here, it seems, historically speaking, is we're the remnants of a mining operation that kind of really got out of control. Now, I know you're all a Bailey folks, and it might be hard to fathom this, but all of this information is coming out of the ground in tablets. And if you read that book, you'll realize precisely why the pyramid was built. It was built as the source of the ability to move heavy stones, and they had a chemical reaction going on to extract hydrogen, and when you bang a hydrogen atom, this electron moves to an outer orbit, and like a piezoelectric motor, when that is finished, the electron moves back into its original orbit, releasing huge amounts of energy. This is the key to the universe. When electrons of hydrogen atoms move from their forced outer orbit back to their original orbit, this is the key to all energy, free energy systems. So they developed this. They pumped the King's Chamber filled with hydrogen, and it created a chain reaction. As it's said in all the ancient scriptures, the pyramid would hum a tone. That's because it was, in fact, creating a certain energy field system that they could control to lift heavy objects and to help get in and out of orbit. I know it sounds strange from...
Oh, you've hit it out on us, Mar. We just lost you.
Okay, that's it.
Okay, well, thank you. So the book he's recommending is The Giza Power Plant. If you're interested, take a look now in Kindle. Okay, do we have anyone else who would like to share?
Yes, we do. Please go ahead, Terry.
All right, thank you. Let's just to add to the point that's already been made, really, and that is that the pyramid not only points up, but it also points, it is a point. And so one is in effect saying that it is showing the oneness of life, which again has been also argued in different terms, but so it's pointing upwards, and at the same time it is a point, it comes to a point.
Yes.
And therefore it is showing the oneness of life. I think it's demonstrating it.
Yes, it's a very basic, but it's a huge part of the symbolism of the pyramid, isn't it? That that the four lines, the four faces, that move through the threeness of the triangles to the oneness of that single point at the top of the pyramid. Mm-hmm. Good point. Thank you. Anyone else?
Yes, hold on just one second here. Go ahead, please, Leah.
The oneness of the point strongly implies the downward facing point coming into it. Sorry, my voice is gone.
No, it's not a problem. Yes, so you're suggesting that it's, in a sense, the invisible point directly above that single point suggests almost like an inverted pyramid. It's interesting. It's almost like the 011 in Fibonacci, isn't it? That you move, this in the sequence, the actual sequence of the Fibonacci is 011, and then it goes up through the numbers 3, 5, 8, 13, etc. And suggesting this crossover into the invisible realms. So, thank you for that. Anyone else?
No, I think that's it for right now.
Okay.
You got another one. Hold on.
I thought I was going to get away from it. No, actually,
please
I
go
love
ahead.
Hearing you.
Please go ahead, Arrest. You're on self-mute. There you go.
Listening to the other person, I have read the book, but there's been a lot of experiments to do with sound, and I think the pyramid has a function to do with sound, and sound is a formative, creative energy which is modulated by the shape, and there is a piezoelectrical function which is causing spiralic ascending energies. So this principle of sound, I think, is crucial to the purpose of the pyramid.
Thank you. Yes. I want to clarify that when I laid in the sarcophagus, this wasn't, and I sounded an om. The sarcophagus physically sounded. It wasn't something that was happening on the inner planes. It physically vibrates at a strong volume, its own tone, when you find just the right pitch. So just to clarify that. Okay. All right. I'm going to cut it short just because, you know, we really could go on with this. It's fascinating to hear your ideas, but we're really running out of time. So I want to describe my idea as to the synthetic purpose of the Great Pyramid and its place in an ordered manifesting plan. After the fall of Atlantis and the consequent destruction of the fourth root race, the Great Pyramid was built, almost certainly at the behest of Sanat Kumara, to ground the energies of the hierarchy and even possibly Shambhala, because there's a strong 1-5 connection through Shambhala, in order to initiate the coming fifth or Aryan root race. It was built as a precisely scaled mathematical model of the Northern Hemisphere, activated by the resonance of the transactional functions pi and phi working in accord, a tremendous feat in transcendental magic, in order to link the Earth to its higher counterpart. The so-called sarcophagus, placed within the pyramid at the analogous level of the dense physical subplane of the mental plane, allowed the consciousness of an acolyte undergoing initiation to be lifted to the highest subplanes of the mental plane, thus aiding him in uniting with his soul and building his antarkarana. Each new initiate strengthened the great Egyptian brotherhood, which sustained a millennia-long age of enlightenment and was ultimately responsible for introducing the sacred mysteries to the East through India and to the West through Greece. Of course, I don't claim this is a factual statement. It's just a hypothesis. So we need to move ahead, so I would love to, you know, even open my interpretation up for further thoughts and comments, but I want to cover this last stage of DK's expanded criteria for analyzing a symbol, which is identification with the quality and purpose of the symbol as it is illuminated by the mind, held steady in the light. This final stage brings into activity the brain as well as the mind. You know, this is a somewhat more expanded meditation compared to the final stage we've been using up till this point, as it requires a deeper level of meditation to achieve a mind held steady in the light. But since during the last hour we've immersed ourselves in a survey of the Great Pyramid, let's give it a shot. Let's attempt to identify with, rather than merely elucidate, the quality and purpose of the Great Pyramid. We'll take exactly 1 minute to do this, starting now. Okay, that's it for today. I hope you've enjoyed the webinar. Next month, we'll continue our survey of the number five by exploring the fifth ray, the color orange, the Hierophant Arcanum in the Tarot, Gebera, the fifth Sephiroth in the Tree of Life, and other aspects of the number five. There are three new items on the reading list. First, pages 1 through 25 in Alice Bailey's Glamour World Problem. For those of you who own the book, if not, you can find this online through Lucas Trust. That's pages 1 through 25. And for those of you with a keen interest in the Great Pyramid, the best book I've found on the subject is Secrets of the Great Pyramids by Peter Tompkins. If you're a math whiz, or would like to be, and want to go even deeper into the mathematical meaning of the Great Pyramid, check out Samuel LeBoy's website at samuelleboy.com. For today's meditation, I'd like to lead you in a guided visualization using stanza one from the stanzas of Sun in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. This is a short but very powerful stanza that speaks of the secret of the fire, relevant both to Pyr amid, fire in the middle, and Phi as the creative fire. If you'd like, visualize yourself in the sarcophagus of the King's Chamber during the recitation. We'll start and end with an Om. The secret of the fire lieth hid in the second letter of the sacred word. The mystery of life is concealed within the heart. When the lower point vibrates, when the sacred triangle glows, when the point, the middle center, and the apex connect and circulate the fire, when the threefold apex likewise burns, then the two triangles, the greater and the lesser, merge into one flame, which burneth up the whole. Okay, that's it for today. Don't forget to donate a few bucks to the Moria Federation at moriafederation.com. which will help pay the yearly fee for this GoToMeeting account and makes these webinars possible. Thank you, Brett, and thanks to Brett. These webinars are available on makara.us, C-M-A-K-A-R-A. And as always, thank you, BL, for your assistance. I really couldn't do this without you. Keep spreading the word. And thank you all for attending. Our next webinar, always on the third Sunday of the month, will be on September 20th, just before the equinox. Okay, bye for now.